Asheville Free Media, ashevillefm.org. This is The Final Straw, and I'm Bursa Goodness. The show can also be heard on KXCF in Marshall, California, KWTF in Bodega Bay, California, KOWALP in Olympia, Washington, and WCRSLP in Columbus, Ohio. Archives of the show can be found at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org, and you can contact us for questions or comment at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net. This week on The Final Straw, we revisit parts of our conversation from June of 2014 with Layla Abdel-Rahim about education, domestication, civilization, solidarity, wildness, and more. Today is Layla's birthday. Happy birthday. More after this musical break.
In the wake of the murders of Mike Brown and Eric Garner, which occurred in the wake of the murders of Oscar Grant and Amado Diallo, which occurred in the wake of thousands of other murders committed by law enforcement, going all the way back to the lynchings of escaped slaves, there's now a national call to equip all law enforcement officers with body cams. Body cams. The idea, of course, is that we can use the technology of the digital surveillance state to spy on police and keep them honest. If we compel all law enforcement to wear body cameras they cannot turn off, the argument goes, the police will behave better, and even when they don't, the video evidence will expose them, and we can weed out the bad apples. If I remember right, that was the argument for installing cruiser cameras. Those are ubiquitous now. Police cruisers routinely have dash cams, and yet, on November 29, 2012, over 60 Cleveland police cruisers took part in a car chase that ended with 13 officers firing 137 shots into the unarmed bodies of Melissa Williams and Timothy Russell. Even though, conceivably, we have 60 different angles to watch the grisly slaughter, that didn't stop Cleveland police officer Michael Brelo from jumping on the hood of the bullet-riddled vehicle and unloading on unarmed civilians right through the windshield. If that's how Officer Brelo acts when he knows he's on camera and he's conscious of it, we can't even guess at the kind of Holocaust he would have committed when no one's looking. I have to assume that the 60 camera angles potentially capturing all of the action had no restraining effect on Brelo or his fellow officers whatsoever. Then there's the murder of Eric Garner, executed by New York police for allegedly selling Lucy's individual cigarettes. I have to wonder where these crusading cops were when the Philip Morris Company was giving my dad emphysema, selling cartons at a time. None of their executives have been strangled with police chokeholds, though they deserve it far more than Eric Garner. But, important to our discussion, those cops knew they were being video recorded via cell phone. They knew. They killed Eric Garner. The video showed it all, the cops got away with it, and they'll probably get promoted. That cell phone surveillance did nothing to restrain them. Then there's John Crawford, shot to death by police in Beaver Creek, Ohio, for playing with a toy gun inside the store that sold the toy gun. All of it was on security video. Police had to have seen the cameras. They had to know that all stores these days have video cameras. They had to have been fully conscious that their actions would be captured on video. And still, they gunned that kid down. Which takes us to the killing of Tamir Rice, a 12-year-old waving around a plastic pistol in Cleveland. The cruiser cams caught it all. Police pulled up and shot him dead. They knew there was a camera. For anyone who really believes that being watched will restrain police abuse, just check out any old episode of Cops. You can't get through a half hour without asking at least once, was that really necessary? Look, I live in the most surveilled space on the planet, and I can't tell you how many times black prisoners were brutalized by white guards and the cameras didn't pick it up, while responses of black prisoners defending themselves always get captured in full Technicolor. Police body cams would invariably work the same way, or should I say, not work. Even proposals by R.A. Washington, who edits Free, an awesome publication available at guidetocultureCleveland.com, falls short. Washington suggests an elected civilian police review board who would have body cam footage and power to discipline police. But such a board would be pressured and paid off and corrupted. Those who are incorruptible would get jailed after anonymous tips to Crime Stoppers uncover kilos of coke in their cars, and they'll be replaced by civilian police review board members who play ball. Body cameras are not the solution. There are only two police officers I feel I can safely say will never shoot unarmed people of color. Lin Jian Liu and Rafael Ramos. This is Ohio Governor in Exile-elect Sean Swain from Ohio Supermax Facility. If you're listening, you are the resistance.
You can write to Sean Swain at Sean Swain, number 243-205, OSP, 878 Coitsville-Hubbard Road, Youngstown, Ohio, 44505. To read some of Sean's writings and learn more about his case, check out seanswain.org. We're speaking with Layla Abdel-Rahim. Layla is an anthropologist, researcher, and public speaker living in Montreal, Quebec. She's also a parent, anarcho-primitivist, and author of several books, most recently Wild Children, Domesticated Dreams, Civilization and the Birth of Education, out from Fernwood Publishing. Info on the book can be found at the publisher's website, fernwoodpublishing.ca. Thanks a lot for coming on, Layla.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So in reading your book, Wild Children, Domesticated Dreams, I really appreciated your inclusion of journal entries and observations as kickstarters to chapters and arguments, many of these centering around your daughter. Is it Luba?
Luba.
Luba,
yes.
Okay. As she grew up and developed. Can you talk about the impetus for writing this book and how it relates to your own experience of parenting?
Well, the book itself, like, as you know, the 130 pages, is kind of a side effect of my research, my life experiences, and my work, but also my experiences, particularly as a graduate student while parenting. And having decided, even before I had my child, that if I ever am to have a child, I would never put that child to school. So it's a lot of reflections, actually, about civilization. Mostly, I would say, like, if to say specifically, I worked in social and medical anthropology in Sweden as a researcher, looking at different conceptions of illness and health as bodies that are viewed by the social culture around them in terms of what roles do they play in that society. So particularly in Sweden, I was comparing the Somalis, the Somali concepts of illness and health and their attitudes or relationship to Swedish social workers and Swedish concepts of illness and health. And then inadvertently, obviously, at the time I was not conscious, but the question of childhood and how children get domesticated within that normalcy of healthy being a functioning human resource and ill is someone who is deviant in a way. Deviant in the sense that either there's an illness that prevents that person from participating in the socioeconomic structure as a human, as laborer, as a human resource, or otherwise, you know, not being able to fulfill the roles to which that society subscribes. And so for Somalis, those concepts were not related to their functionability in the Swedish socioeconomic structure. And the question of children, who has the right to domesticate and to use the children, to integrate them as future human resources, was a constant sharp edge between these two communities. And so I left Sweden in 1998, and basically my child, so I went back to Russia, and my child was born a year after, so in March 1999. So obviously that research was very fresh. And so exploring my own relationship to that child and having a child in a Russia that has not defined its post-Soviet trajectory yet. There was a lot of anarchist groups or different groups that did not even call themselves anything, especially in terms of parenting. Our friends had, you know, a movement, for example, you know, the Going Back to the Sea inspired by Tchaikovsky, but not following like everything that Tchaikovsky prescribed. So it was very interesting. So kind of traveling and, you know, exploring the world with our children in that respect was very interesting to compare with my previous Swedish experience. And so I guess the ideas were parallel to my research. So when I came to Canada and started my PhD program, a few courses that I took, there was constantly that issue of what am I going to write, what is being expected. And so I felt that normalizing narrative of me as a healthy kind of student, as a participating student in the production of the knowledge that is sponsored by the state, not articulated clearly like that, but in the comments and the expectations of the professors from my work, it was very obvious. So in a way, it was my first essay in the book on objects, love, and objectifications came as an exploration of how that space is being structured. And the second on modernism and education was a response to a professor's really like adamant attempt to integrate me and domesticate me into her way of seeing what it is that students are to produce, or how are they to participate in that production of knowledge as healthy academics. And obviously I wasn't. So in a way, so that was in 2002, those chapters came, and then they went all around. I put them on the internet, and then the book finally kind of just materialized itself in a couple of weeks in 2011.
Well, very much enjoyed reading through it. It's really complex and jam-packed with ideas. For the sake of the listening audience, would you mind, who may not be familiar with Critiques of Civilization and Domestication, can you talk really briefly about when you refer to civilization, what do you mean? And when you refer to domestication, what do you mean?
Okay, so for me, civilization is actually the material outcome of the sum of the relationships and decisions or say strategies for subsistence that a community or a society chooses. So civilization in this respect is not, as in the mainstream usually is taken to be, like human advancement. To me, any group, any species, or any group within any species, because not even like the whole of human species have chosen civilization. So there would be, for example, some ants would choose civilized relationships, others wouldn't, right? So what characterizes those strategies for subsistence? Basically, if we look at wilderness, in wilderness, there's diversity. There's the constant movement towards innovation, towards tuning to how the world lives, how the world changes, so that every individual and every species can do their best to support that diversity and to live, because to live implies that you need that diversity. You cannot just live as a single species in an environment that is has nothing else but yourself, right? So there's a lot of intricacies involved in decisions, in tuning in and understanding, intelligence. So when we look at civilized relationships, it's usually a group or a species that favors itself above everything else at the expense of diversity. So usually imposes a kind of monocultural perspective, and monoculturally identified interests, so for that group. So you can say viruses that take over an organism usually favor that monoculturalism at the expense of the environment in which they reproduce, until that environment, if the environment cannot contain that outburst, that epidemic, the environment dies, right? So the organism collapses with cancer with viruses, with bacteria that is overwhelming. Mostly bacteria, though, keep a balance of diversity and life in a symbiotic manner. So they reciprocate. And the same with human civilizations. This is what we're witnessing right now. The result of that monocultural decision to value human species and to value ownership within that species, which already stratifies even human species in terms of who is the resource and who is the owner of the resource. It creates this imbalance and this monocultural perspective that is not viable. And the result is a civilized reality. Domestication is the method of civilizing, of training resources or identifying if they're non-human or non-living resources as ownership. And so domestication entails that you possess the raison d'être, so the reason for existence of that resource that you identify as your resource.
And in the book, you point out, for instance, that one application of this would be in terms of non-human animals as, like, they are viewed as food sources, or trees are viewed as lumber. They're what John Zerzan would say is, like, reification. They're reified. They're turned into things that are possessed, or their purpose is, as you say, their, yeah, raison d'être. Is that right?
Yeah.
Excellent. I don't speak French. But yeah, is to serve a certain need for human beings. I think it was really interesting the way that you talked about food chains and in some of the earlier essays, and in particular, the conversation, bringing it back to this classroom setting that I imagine you witnessed, where different children were shown pictures of zebras. And can you go through that, what that was?
Yes, absolutely. That was a project here in Montreal from UNICEF. It was a project with schools and different libraries. There were contests, and it was called Diversity Project. And so the group would go. The workshop basically entailed to have kids from different ages. There were different groups, and I observed them to ask. Basically, that particular example was in terms of the children were asked to draw something from their lives or neighborhoods, something they experienced. And then the animators were going to use those drawings to kind of point to the importance of diversity. And yes, that was really heartbreaking in the sense that there was one child who kind of didn't refuse, but he expressed that diversity in a wild sense, which is exactly like the whole point and how he was domesticated. Basically, the children would, like, some would draw whatever, you know, a rabbit or a dog or a tree, and the animator would go, okay, Susan, what is a dog for? Or a dog is to guard. Uh-huh, nice. What is the tree for? Oh, the tree is to give us shade or air or something, you know? And then this one boy drew, like, this really intricate painting. And so there was, like, a lion, a zebra, you know, like, a sun, the sun was shining. And the animator asks him, oh, so, Zeki, what is, what did you draw? And he's like, well, this is a zebra, this is a lion, this is, like, okay, and why do they exist? So here the question already frames an expectation from the children that nothing should exist for their own selves. They should exist for a reason, and that reason is identified by the human beings. And so we, the animators, the carriers of knowledge of that reason, shall now guide you to understand and unlock that reason for existence. So this is like the underlying message in the whole exercise. And so she asks, what do zebras exist for? And he said, well, they're pretty and they run fast. And the animator explains, no. She's like, well, you know, all the other kids answered correctly. No, Zaki, you know, the zebras exist for the lions to be eaten, you know, and here is the domestication through representation, which is a big problem in itself. You know, that's like, you know, John Zerzan's critique of symbolic culture and representation. It's easy when you take that image and you put that image in a category, an epistemological category of how we construct knowledge, how we know the world, without actually going and interacting with the zebra and seeing, why does the zebra exist? Does the zebra see that she exists for the lion? Does the lion think every single zebra exists for its own satiation? No, the lions don't, like, I grew up in Africa, I've been around animals, I've been in the savannah, and for the most part, the gazelles, the zebras, they wander around, the lions sleep, and everybody knows at what point would the lioness go hunting, and there's a mobilization, and so everyone lives, everyone runs, everyone enjoys their lives, and everyone cooperates to protect each other. And when the lioness catches someone, it's usually someone old or sick, and still the lioness will never catch all the zebras, will never catch all the old or weak zebras. A lot of them will die of old age. So there is that wild reason for existence just for their own pleasure of existence that we cannot and should not meddle with and try to appropriate and possess. And this is what people find it really difficult, domesticated or civilized people. Like usually the first thing, and it's usually men actually, white men in my talks, when I talk about this circle of predation that is a humanist invention in order to justify our own predatory culture and civilization. So the first thing is usually, oh, wolves hunt, oh, lions eat. So I'm like, well, lions don't hunt all the time, everyone, and you are not a lion, you are not a wolf. So that is not a logical analogy even to make, a reasonable analogy. So that's basically
I'd like to get back to education, but before that, there was that, what you were just saying about the purpose of these animals reminded me of some of the stuff that I remember reading in Empathy, Cooperation, and Interspecies Mutual Aid in the book. And you drew out, I have not personally read that much Kropotkin, but you drew out some, and it wasn't just Kropotkin, but pointed to a number of research projects that have shown these really interesting interactions between species or within certain species, like rats, for instance, not knowing each other, but being willing to like provide food or help out another rat that it's not related to if it's been helped out by a stranger rat before. That was really fascinating to, I've heard of that sort of thing. And I've of course seen the YouTube videos, but of, you know, cats helping mice or whatever, but I hadn't really been aware of that many instances and that wide ranging. Can you talk about like that sort of research and what sort of conclusions can be drawn from it?
Yes. Well, you know, for me personally, I mean, I understand, and obviously, you know, to make my arguments, I do rely on research. I understand kind of the importance of backing my arguments with this kind of research in this kind of civilized setting. However, myself personally, I did not need any research to arrive at these conclusions. And I know a lot of the people who have not lost their empathy or their curiosity about how, you know, trying to discover how others live, you know, in our species or, it's, you know, other species. There is that logical conclusion that you can draw just by going to the desert and watching the life that goes on in the sand. And you understand that if even in deserts there is life, it somehow happened. So when Kropotkin went to Siberia and made his observations, it was, you know, this kind of curiosity. Well, how does life happen? What is the principle of survival? And he finds out, well, you know, the whole concept of survival is, again, a civilized concept, because if life thrived through billions of years, it means that the world was meant for life, and that life should be thriving. And when life is thriving, it's pleasant. It's not a survival. It's not like a chore you carry, like, okay, you know, how many years am I going to drag this, right? It's a pleasure of being. And not in this civilized, hedonistic, that's a totally different kind of misconception of the pleasure of being in the world. Okay, it's again, you know, hedonism within civilization is a result of gorging and devouring and misappropriating resources. Again, it's rooted in the concept of resources, and that leads us to some possessing resources and others, again, you know, acting as objects of pleasure. And you have the whole like conception of gender and sexual pleasure, you know, inebriation. It all comes with this civilized need to kind of disengage from empathy and from the world in order to be able to loot to loot it and pollute it and destroy it and use it and just for your own joy. So that's like another. But in the wild, it's just really pleasant to be in the company of that diversity of life. And the landscape could be different. It's a very different pleasure of being in the desert. It's a very different pleasure of being in the ocean, on the mountain, in the forest, in the jungle. Every single corner is so magnificent and so wonderful. And so we don't need a study to tell us that in order for life to be so beautiful and the world to be so beautiful, it has to have certain cooperation standards, certain standards of mutuality, because it's only in parasitic relationships that there is pain. Because if one extracts pleasure only one way without giving back, then the object of that extraction at a certain point is drained out and dies. It can be an individual specimen, or it could be a whole community. It could be a single community. It could be a diverse community. And so, in this respect, then, it's, to me, every time I see these studies on mice and animals, it's like my heart cringes, because we should not be studying them in these environments. It's like, but at the same time, these observations obviously reveal to the surprised civilized individuals and groups that, oh, well, mice do have this intelligence. Well, obviously they have this intelligence. They've been around longer than us. Grass, I keep saying always, probably is the most intelligent, because that's been, or amoeba in the ocean, have been longer than any mammals. And so they must be the most intelligent, the most empathic, the most giving, and the ones that need the most of our reverence. You know, you look at, I cite Jit Kalasa in, a Native American writer in my book, you know, and how she talks about the meadow, you know, the flowers, those people, those folks of different colors, and the green blades, and how they look. And this is who they are, you know, they are just there for themselves. You don't cut them, you don't pick them, you just tiptoe and marvel.
More after this musical break.
Thank you.
back with mother feminist and archiprimitivist Leila Adel Rahim on civilization and her book Wild Children, Domesticated Dreams.
So if domestication and civilization includes and requires people to be disengaged from the rest of the natural world that we should be existing as a part of and with, and even if you're not utilizing mind frame towards something, it means not thinking about things that aren't potentially useful. That thing doesn't exist because it's not potentially useful for me. So I think that pointing to those studies can be a way of, it should be a simple thing for us to be able to open our eyes and just observe. But even getting to the point of having our eyes wide enough to be able to see relationships and realize the implications of how the world lives and how we live within it and with each other and with ourselves, I think that it's not a simple step. It is a simple step, but most of us aren't open to taking it, I think.
Yes, I understand. And there's also, for example, for me, because I'm kind of, I don't like the word in between cultures, because I actually did take from different cultures. So Russian culture, Sudanese, British colonial, because that was my schooling. Then the US, that's where I did my undergraduate studies, lived for 5 years, traveled extensively. Canada, Sweden, obviously. So these are all the cultures from which, with which I engage and from whom I take what is good and I critique what is not good. And I find, part of civilization is that it always finds a way to create a religion. And so it's very difficult to argue with religious people. And in this kind of religious conception, I include atheists and scientists, because those scientists and those atheists who kind of dogmatically state certain things that are basically, they derive their privileges, scientific or atheist privileges, from those statements. It becomes really difficult to argue with them otherwise. So regardless of whether you are a religious Muslim or Christian or atheist, it is really difficult to convince people that humanity and humanism not only is not the only conscious group out there in the universe, but could be actually, because of civilization and domestication, lacking intelligence and lagging behind in their possibility to adapt to life, because they have tuned out of that empathic intelligence, of empathic knowledge of how the world lives. And then we come to these studies that, yes, they're useful to illustrate. I mean, it is beautiful what Alexander showed with the rat park, right? But my own kid has made a very similar observation about humans. But to make that step between humans and rats for the civilized is still not, very difficult, even with a study like this. Because obviously if those studies proved anything to the religious humanists, we would long ago have solved many of the problems. But obviously we still need to continue to prove that, poor people suffer because they are being wronged by society. You still need to convince. You still need to argue. You still need to, and this is the irony, to fund projects, to study. Do poor people really suffer? Do rats really have solidarity or feel pain? Are they conscious? Are they aware of their pain? Well, yeah, maybe they do feel pain, but they're not conscious. They're not aware of their pain. So therefore, it's okay, So, but how about we fund another study? And so this is the irony with these studies. But obviously, anyone who observes animals, it's amazing. Actually, recently there was a study at McGill. I can't remember exactly the name of the professor who did the study, but it's a McGill University study on animals and rats. And that apparently it was a study on pain. So that's already sadistic. Okay. So they were studying how would rats react to pain or how would pain manifest in rats. And they, after a while, they found that there was something wrong. The rats did not, when the experimenters were present, the rats actually hid. They did not manifest their pain. And then the cameras caught that the minute the people left, they started letting go and kind of letting go there and this, you know, showing that they were actually in pain. So it showed that then there's a gender relationship also, in the sense that, okay, the rats reacted differently in the presence of male experimenters or researchers and female experimenters and researchers. And so, well, you know, then what is the question about rats and, you know, their ability to not demonstrate or to control their pain? It's like you control your tears in public because you're a man, right? You're taught that way, and so this is how you are going to be socialized. What does that tell us about the rat's relationship to the experimenters, their kind of self-awareness, and this horrible reality that you actually need to induce pain in order to observe? That's like, that is sadistic. And so what do we do with this? Like, do we quote the research like that? Do we use it to demonstrate something? Some of the experiments I quote, but others I still cannot go that way, even when I am aware of them.
That makes a lot of sense. Here's a perfect quote. Quote, scientists whisper to each other at conferences that their rodent research subjects appear to be aware of their presence and that this might affect the results of experiments. But this has never been directly demonstrated until now, unquote, says Jeffrey Mogul, a psychology professor at McGill and senior author of the paper.
Perfect.
Yeah.
So what does science teach? You see, this is my kind of critique of the whole project of education, because it engages both in the production of knowledge and in the transmission of this knowledge. So if the premise itself already starts from civilization, then any knowledge that such a project endorses, I'm not saying that there is no rebellion or resistance within civilization, but this resistance and rebellion is obviously not endorsed and punished severely. Okay, so anything that is endorsed usually goes to prove the very premise, the very basic premise of civilization. And so this is a perfect illustration of that. Still, they are not convinced. Still, they need to be fed in order to carry on more research to check on whether, even though, well, let the mice go and go into the woods and you'll have a much healthier relationship with them, because you will, when the rats or the mice will decide to reveal to you how they live, how they experience joy or pain, then you will be privy to a very special relationship of trust. And if you're not invited, then do you have the right to be a voyeur, a pervert that induces pain in order to observe it, or induces anything in an incarceration environment in order to observe, well, what happens next? And that's the whole premise of that knowledge. And it starts from school, from, you know, with these kids in this diversity project. Kindergarten, like, you know, kids' books, education is all rooted in that premise.
You make a very clear and strong arguments against domestication in regards to animal agency, rape culture among human animals, policies concerning reproductive freedom, social hierarchies and disability, among other things. Can we explore maybe like this? Because in terms of like utilization and usefulness, and you talk about domestication and civilization and how gender plays out in that.
Okay. Well, yes, because the whole construction of gender started with the very concept of domestication. because if we're talking about if you're talking about non-living resources, well, it's just basically you're concerned with property rights and a way to protect those rights, right? If you're concerned with living resources, then if the living resources die and refuse to reproduce, then basically you can use them for this period of time and that's it. And this is where, again, reproduction, education, gender, and violence come in as really like intrinsic part of civilization and domestication, without which civilization wouldn't have had a chance to survive. And that is then you identify who is going to reproduce the resources, the physical bodies, and who is going to reproduce the indoctrination or the epistemology by which those resources are going to function within that hierarchical system of ownership and resource or work, right? Or labor.
And that could be kind of compared to like sorting seeds or like some of the practices of breeding ducks together to get this certain kind of duck, right? Like forcing them to not have the ability to choose wildly and freely in a way that would probably better strengthen their offspring, be healthier, because it wouldn't be a forced thing. But
absolutely. The word healthier is the problem because, yeah, healthier in the sense that mutated enough to survive the insane side effects and horrors and the illness of civilization, because obviously the strain of reproduction, because then you need to maximize the resource production, right? So you are going to force the females to produce who you want and how many you want. So that becomes their labor class. This is the femaleness now exists as a category for the production of your resources. It becomes a class, a labor class that is laboring, quite literally, in every sense, like in several, like all the puns intended. And so it applies both to human and to non-human resources. But then also with patriarchy, because then if the woman is the one who controls the reproduction of resources, she could have a say and rebel or resist, right? But if you disempower, if you have the epistemology that institutionalizes a patriarchal and patrilineal transmission of power and capital, material and social capital, then you have it all set. Because for the woman to participate in this system of lack of distribution of resources and capital, the only way is to produce and to agree to produce more. Because and this is how all these patriarchal civilizations, by their nature, are patriarchal. And this is how they have come about and how they function. You reward the woman only in that, to that extent that she reproduces. And so the men then decide who marries whom, how the wealth goes down. And it's the same with the animals. Like you, the farmer, the engineer, the genetic engineer decides, and it's usually male, it's not a coincidence, decides who you're going to mate, how you're going to mate, and then you are going to use all the unwanted males for meat or labor, and the females, say, for example, I use the example of turkeys or cows in my book, you use them for reproduction and milk, and how do you then go about insemination? That's rape. And so this is the very, it's like to your face, but in symbolic culture, you can call it something else. You can call it insemination. You can call it husbandry. So it doesn't appear violent. You are going to identify only human animals as being capable of experiencing rape. And still, in specific circumstances, because not every rape is equal in civilization. And we see how all these courts handle cases of rape in the States, in India, anywhere in the world. A woman could be raped, and sometimes it is decided that it is a case of rape, and sometimes not, because the narrative of civilization sees it as normal. This is the basis of civilized relationships that we are not aware of. And only when we start looking at it from the perspective of wilderness, that if women, and in wilderness, there isn't even that category, it's an anthropological category of womanhood, even when it applies to turkey women or bovine women, right? It's still an anthropological construct in the sense that it stems from our identification of humanity and agency, who has the right to reproduce and who has the right to force or improve reproduction. This is how it's referred to. And so if it is seen as improving the reproduction, then it's not rape. And this is the narrative that kids tune into really early in school, like in kindergarten. They already are getting in that kind of macho culture, and the girls are geared towards their future reproductive services, you know, at that stage. And the incredibly tragic, but at the same time, kind of normal development of civilization, the cases of rape and the harassment that comes with it, and the lack of desire of the courts to do anything about it, should reveal to the people that, well, because the concepts of justice are based on normalizing and naturalizing such relationships, these will not be persecuted. Even here in Canada, I know in the States, Canada has this reputation of being the more just and more kind of the softer nation. But in cases of rape, in the eastern provinces, a couple of years ago, a young woman was raped. It was recorded, it was YouTubed, and she was harassed, persecuted. Nothing was done to the rapist, even though everybody knew, and she committed suicide. It's only one example of so many others. And it's been time, 10,000 years ago, this should have been contained. But, okay, well, we've been through 10,000 years of civilization. Isn't it time for people to look at the situation and say, well, obviously it hasn't worked, the system of justice.
Let's see. So here's a narrative. There's an assumption that's taught to children through education and the passed on from parents and everything as to why the way that we live is the best way to live and why so many other people are attempting to, in our mindset, are attempting to adopt our means of living in relation to the world in terms of civilization and our domestication of animals and the hierarchies that we've built, that it's necessary for – it's a manifest destiny story almost that people developed communities and hierarchies and privatized the land and imprisoned people and declared war on other peoples because basically we were able to, and therefore that right is there. People were conquered because their communities were weaker. And we settled and started agriculture because it made us healthier. And with that health and vigorousness, we began expanding our reproduction just through that vigor and taking over other areas. Like, this is the narrative that we're taught in Western civilization, is that manifest our mm-hmm. strengths and our goodness and our quote-unquote health is manifest in the fact that the society with which we participate and whose values we have inculcated dominates.
Yes, absolutely. And for that narrative to work, the very first step that civilization took was to establish this, to naturalize human predation, to focus on predators and to say that, okay, because there are predators and predators are the successful, like you start attributing success and failure to different modes of relating, but taken out of their context. Because obviously in wilderness, billions of, the majority of species on Earth were not predators. Had they been predators, obviously they would have devoured everything, just like we did, right? So the predators were always the minority. They reproduced less, they slept more, they ate much less. And this is, their digestive systems are very different, and their social relations are very different, precisely in order to continue to be in the minority, in order to just not to take over, right? And so the non-predators flourished, and primates like us flourished. And for the most part, well, most primates are actually almost 100% frugivores and herbivores. They eat fruit and veggies and greens, with the exception of very few that would consume some proteins, and usually it's ants or worms or insects. And with one group in a species of these apes, that some of them, and only one group of that group, called now Homo sapiens, the wise ape, which is also...
Yeah, of course, we named ourselves.
Exactly. It's a joke in itself. And so they came up with the idea that we should, that scavenging should become hunting. And with hunting, the representation and the normalization of that mode of life, which was still, mind you, just like with the chimps, less than 10% of their diet is protein, insect or small animal, and small animal only when human induced the desertification started occurring due to farming and cities, expansion of cities. But humans originally did not consume that much, maybe scavenging a little bit when they seemed to be some catastrophes. But when hunting started happening and symbolic language and symbolic culture started emerging, to me that is not a coincidence. It seems that at a certain point, some groups started favoring that culture of subsistence. And with that, then, in a way, with the first murder, and actually I talk about that, I have a play called Red Delicious, interpretation of our monotheistic narrative and science, the intersections with science and academia and civilization, and how the first murder could have been the birth of impatience, which is time, and so our separation from the earth, from a holistic conception of all these dimensions of space and time, into regulated time that is separate from the regulated space, which you control and abuse. And this this predatory narrative is the one then that is responsible for the ability of that group to devise a totally new culture, which is intrinsically, inherently colonizing and expansionist. And so with that expansion, and it starts with the fact that if you are going to hunt, you need a point to where the hunters would return. So maybe a beginning of sedentarism needed to be starting right there, with women collecting most of the food sources from the area, and women wanting to economize their effort because now they needed to have the surplus, because hunting is not economically viable, because you need to spend much more energy hunting a living being than what you can yield. You can, like, a hunter cannot feed the family. It's like one adventure, you bring it, you eat it. You need a predatory digestive system. But to go back to the beginning of civilization, agriculture, when you start possessing the land and needing all these resources and energy in order to dominate it and protect it from invaders, there's incredible toll on health. More people are needed in a specific space that are need to be exploited with constant borrowing of energy from other sources, that and the crowded conditions and the malnourishment and the overwork kind of grows as civilization advances. And so the health, the paleontological findings show that that is when the health, especially of women and children, started giving in, and civilized agricultural women, children, and the elderly started dying off much earlier. Now have findings of Neanderthal bones that show that they could live even without teeth until old age because the community helped each other and they never had a settlement with exploitation. You know, there was mutual cooperation and mutual aid. But with agricultural civilizations and cities and settlements, it became one-way hierarchical drawing of energy from the bottom to the top. And so those who were at the top would obviously maybe have better lives because they had all the other working on their behalf. But the lower you go down the hierarchy, the larger the base of the hierarchy of the exploited, okay, that usually with the animals and women of color at the bottom. And that's when you have all the suffering and early mortality, which has never gone away. It's the same today. Like, you trace that decrease in health and longevity, it is still here today. And we compare statistics of one and the same city, poor neighborhood, rich neighborhood, sometimes 10 years, sometimes up to 28 years of difference in longevity within the same city between the rich and the poor. And so the myth of that health and improvement is a myth that is generated obviously from those who have experienced that improvement, or they claim it to be improvement. Actually, they probably would have enjoyed a much better life in the wilderness along with everyone else. But since they are at the top and they don't see the bottom and they have forgotten what it's like to go out in the wilderness, and their symbolic capital and wealth makes it easy for them to buy off life of the others, animal and non-human animals, then it's easy to kind of come up with that myth and spread it around. Well, look, if you work hard enough, you'll be like us. The statistics show us it's not true. Most poor people are either killed or die from diseases, from depression, from suicide, from whatever. It is not true.
It's like promising the horizon to someone.
Yes.
Thank you so much for this conversation. Really enjoyed it. I'd like to chat some other time.
Absolutely.
Asheville Free Media, ashevillefm.org. This is The Final Straw, and I'm Bursa Goodness. The show can also be heard on KXCF in Marshall, California, KWTF in Bodega Bay, California, KOWALP in Olympia, Washington, and WCRSLP in Columbus, Ohio. Archives of the show can be found at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org, and you can contact us for questions or comment at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net.